From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, GM plant closings, thousands of jobs being eliminated, a wake-up call for Michigan.
Autos have been an engine for growth coming out of the Great Recession for Michigan, and it looks like that's not so much going to be the case the next several years.
It's lame duck time in Lansing.
At this point in the term, and especially when you've got 8 years of total Republican control coming to an end, this is put up or shut up time.
John U. Bacon on the 101st anniversary of the Great Halifax Explosion.
904.35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone.
And Dickens' A Christmas Carol will be hitting theater stages all around Michigan. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. And now the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There were plenty of shockwaves generated by GM's announcement that it will stop production at five factories in the U.S. and Canada and eliminate some 14,000 blue and white-collar jobs. Two of those plants, Detroit Hamtramck Assembly and Warren Transmission, are located in southeast Michigan. So what does this news ultimately mean for Michigan? Let's find out now as we turn to Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. Charlie, were you surprised by GM's announcement?
I was not expecting it on the particular day when it happened, but I was not completely surprised. Two things are going on. One is that the North American auto sales, you know, they plummeted 9 years ago, and then they slowly came back. The last couple of years, they've been pretty flat. It seems like we've got a limit at about 17 million cars and light trucks. And so there's not much room for growth. And the other thing that's going on is that there's been this change in what Americans want to buy. We used to buy passenger cars. We used to buy sedans. Now that's less than a third of the market. The market is in crossovers, SUVs, and pickups. And so the plants that are closing and the plants that might be vulnerable for future closing are the ones that make these vehicles that are less popular than they used to be.
How worried should we all be in Michigan about the fact that these plants, we've got, you know, two plants right here in Michigan that are going to be shuttered? How worried should we be?
Well, I think we should be at least a little worried. Here in the Lansing area, we have two plants. One of them is, I think, somewhat vulnerable to the same kinds of market conditions that have led to these other closings. Taken by itself, these closings, yes, it's devastating for the couple of thousand workers involved, and then there will be ripple effects, like businesses that are really close to the Detroit Hamtramck plant, they'll have fewer customers going by. But that doesn't amount to a great recession. I don't want people to overstate how bad this is. This is not 2009. But yeah, it's worrying, and worrying down the road is if the auto industry is not going to provide growth in the next, in the next several years, what will? And a lot of possible answers, but that has been autos have been an engine for growth coming out of the Great Recession for Michigan. And it looks like that's not so much going to be the case the next several years.
Well, you know, as we talk about this, we know the auto industry is cyclical. It is no secret to anyone. And you think about how when things go badly, like during the Great Recession, or I'm thinking of the early 1980s, there's all this talk in Michigan about we need to diversify, not be so tied to the auto industry. And then things get better, vehicle sales boom, and we back off the gas and stop talking about diversification. So is it time to get serious and really dive into building other industries besides ones that have to do with vehicles?
It's always time. There's never a bad time to think about and start planning for further diversification of our economy. To our credit, you know, Michigan is a more diverse economy than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Now, that's partly because we've just lost so much of the manufacturing, but it's also because we have gained other things, healthcare, IT, but there are a lot of other sectors where I think we could do more. We could do more probably to promote tourism. We could do more to try to attract finance and insurance. There's a lot of things going on in the economy outside of manufacturing, and that's going to be true for a very long time.
And really, thinking about that during the 2000s, wasn't that the point of film credits, of the tax credits to attract the film industry to Michigan?
Yes. Now, I wasn't a huge fan of those film credits, to be honest with you. I mean, that was the idea, certainly, is let's do something new. But the amount of money that we poured onto some of those movies, I'm not sure that we got a great return on that.
I'm talking with Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. Thinking, Charlie, of cities like Detroit and Hamtramck and Warren in particular, where these targeted plants are located, and for the workers, these thousands of workers who appear to be out of a job going past 2019, how do things look for them to land? How, based on Michigan's economic situation right now?
Well, right now, you know, our unemployment rate is lower than it's been since 2000. Our economy is continuing to grow, and so at least for a lot of those workers, I'm very hopeful that there will be good opportunities. Now, honestly, in many cases, they may have trouble finding a comparable job because, you know, there's something special about those auto sector jobs. Many of those people have been in those factories for many years, and it is just unquestionable that it's a wrenching experience to lose it. I think a lot of them will land on their feet. I also think that especially the ones who are upper 50s, pushing 60, maybe even in their early 60s, some of them may just say, okay, I was planning to retire when I'm 64, but I'll retire when I'm 62 or something like that.
And we're also talking white-collar workers because they're thinning those ranks.
Exactly. It's not just the production line workers. In fact, the total number of white-collar workers is larger than the production workers. So, I think a lot of those folks may have an easier time finding alternative employment than some of the production line workers because they may have skills that would more easily transfer to other businesses. But it's really going to be very much on a case-by-case basis. I think some of these workers will land on their feet quickly and easily. Others, it's going to be a struggle.
And when you think of the cities, you think of a city like Hamtramck or a city like Warren. What's that going to mean for them in local government revenue and the kind of effect they may suffer?
Well, of course, Hamtramck is not in great shape to mm-hmm. begin with in terms of its local finances. It's a hit. There's just no question about it. And this gets me back to one of the things that we've talked about before. I think the state of Michigan has been, I think it's just been unconscionable the way that the state has turned its back on local governments by slashing revenue sharing. And I think especially when you look at a community that's impacted in this way, I hope that the state will do more for them than we've done for our local governments generally. Beyond the effect on local government revenues, there is the effect of just the psychology of it. This is a blow to a community's sense of itself, to a community's self-esteem. I'm looking for ways to sugarcoat that, but
yeah.
I'm not coming up with it.
And there is all signs point to Ford following suit at some point. What are you hearing, and what is your best guess as to how deep those cuts might go?
Well, I've heard a lot of possibilities, and I'm not sure that I want to speculate on exactly what. But, yes, Ford is in an extremely similar situation to GM. Their market share has been flat. The total market is flat, and they're finding this change in what people want to buy. And so that means if they've got plants that are producing cars instead of trucks and SUVs and crossovers, those are vulnerable, and some of those are in Michigan, and I wouldn't be surprised if we saw Ford following GM's lead at some point. I hope it's later rather than sooner.
You know, with the announcement of that news from General Motors on Monday, GM shares rose 5%, but here we have just lost about 7,000 blue and white-collar jobs in Southeast Michigan, GM jobs, and some 14,000 nationally. So is this a case of short-term pain for long-term gain?
Well, I think that looking at it from GM's perspective, after all, they are a company that they're in business to make money, and they have harsh memories of 9 years ago. And I think that the market, the stock market, looked at them and said, hey, they are, instead of waiting for the crisis, they are moving proactively to try to strengthen their position now and also to provide the funds for planning for the kind of car company that they think they will be in 2030, which has to do with autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles. They, Mary Barra and the people at GM, just like everybody else, they see an industry that's changing rapidly. So I think it makes sense as a business decision, but it does tell you that what is good for Wall Street is not necessarily good for Main Street. There's a real disconnect there. The people in Wall Street cheer because this probably strengthened GM's profitability for the long haul. But if you're in Hamtramck, it's not looking so good.
Is there any good news for Michigan in all of this, Charlie?
Oh, good news. Well, you know, I guess maybe the good news that I could come up with is what we were talking about earlier. If it reminds us once again that we need to search out all sorts of other things and we need not to rely exclusively on any one industry, that might be a silver lining in this cloud.
And what will you be watching as this all unfolds in coming months?
Well, I'm going to be watching a whole bunch of indicators. Employment is certainly one. The growth of the economy has slowed down a little bit, especially in manufacturing. I noticed lately that last week, analysts at J.P. Morgan Chase raised their estimate of the probability of a recession in the next 12 months. So they said that probability is now up to one chance in three. Mm. You know, we're going to watch, I think economists everywhere are going to be watching carefully to see what ripple effects happen from if these tariffs on steel and aluminum continue, whether the trade war with China deepens. There's a lot of things to be concerned about.
Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. As always, Charlie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Michigan legislators are back at it in Lansing for their post-2018 election lame duck session. And with the Republicans' complete control of state government after 8 years, there's a lot of legislation that could see movement before Governor-elect Whitmer takes the helm.
We're going to hear a lot about the bill to authorize the construction of a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac, the relocation of Line 5 and other utility connections.
That's up next on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for Theater Talk as we check out professional theater offerings around Michigan with David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And absolutely no surprise, we are in a holiday mood this time around, starting out with Old Ebenezer Scrooge, Bob Cratchit, and Tiny Tim. Where do we start?
Well, we've already talked about this one last time, but it's worth mentioning again. The Christmas Carol at the Meadowbrook Theater on the campus of Oakland University. Cynthia, this is an amazing annual production. A lot of the same actors are in and year out, so there's a lot of polish on it. The set is unbelievable. Their production is like a Victorian pop-up Christmas card that just comes to life before your very eyes. I mean, it's just over the top. It's really breathtaking. I'm kind of a Scroogeaholic, Scrooge aficionado, so I can't recommend that one enough. But and it's not the only Scrooge in town.
Not at all. Right? I mean, they've been doing it for 37 straight years at Meadowbrook. We know they know how to do it, but Wayne State's got a production.
They do, and it is also a very good one, year in, year out, and it opens this coming weekend.
And then for little ones who might have shorter attention spans.
Yes, the Wild Swan Theater here in Ann Arbor, they perform over at Washtenaw Community College, and it's a great facility. And they have a Christmas Carol that they've adapted and kind of cut down. It's just 55 minutes long, so that's kind of their sweet spot for the young ones. So special adaptation, and also I've seen this before, Very recommended for the young kids.
So not maybe maybe the Ghost of Christmas Future isn't quite as scary as it might be.
I would say, yes.
All right. So moving on from Ebenezer Scrooge and Jacob Marley's Ghost, tell us what is going on at Theater Nova in Ann Arbor.
So Theater Nova for the last few years has performed a panto, a Christmas panto, which is, for people who are not familiar, it's a British kind of genre, and it features – it's farce. It's got music. It's got song. It usually has a cross-dresser or two. It's silly. It's silly stuff. And so – and they've written an original one, you know, for each year they've done it. The last 3 years, I believe. And this one is called The Elves and the Schumachers.
Okay.
And I really recommend these. You can take the whole family, so it's not just for adults. And the cast this year is really terrific. Dan Morrison, Sarah Stevens, and Liz Jaffe. These are three of the best actors around. In fact, Sarah Stevens won Best Our Wild Award for Best Actress last season. And so that's at the Yellow Barn, which is on Huron in Ann Arbor. That opens this weekend as well.
All right. And now we go to the Monster Box Theater in Waterford in Oakland County. And I think something that is really going to speak to public radio listeners.
Yes. They are doing a play called The Book of Liz. And this is a play by David and Amy Sedaris, public radio favorites.
Absolutely.
It's a play that is a bit of a send up on religious communities. It follows a woman named Liz who leaves a community. It's a little bit of a play on the Amish. And she encounters a number of comic strangers on her journey in search of something that was missing from her life and on the inside. It's funny. You know, it's kind of a little bit of a string of these, right? Book of Mormon, mm-hmm. Hand to God.
Yeah.
There are actors or writers and actors that, you know, this seems to be a little bit of a fertile area. Yeah. I'm not sure why exactly, but it's David and Amy Sedaris. And, you know, if you like their brand of humor, which a lot of people do, especially
yes,
those that listen here, it's definitely worth seeing. And that's the Monster Box in Waterford. I like this theater. It's in a strip mall. It's one of my strip mall theaters,
yeah.
And they're doing really good work in a community that doesn't have another theater. So
very good. Now, everyone, take a listen to this, and you're going to know exactly what's opening next week at the Wharton Center in East Lansing.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard.
Those songs never get old, do they? Fiddler on the Roof.
They really don't. And this touring production looks very good to me. And again, only if you've been living in another dimension have you not seen or heard this show. My mother played the grooves out of the album, the Herschel Bernardi cast album, when I was a kid.
Yes, yes.
And so this is the Jerry Bock, Sheldon Harnick, and Joseph Stein musical about a Jewish family in Tsarist Russia. Head of the family is dealing with the independence exerted by his three daughters and the coming eviction from their village by the ruling government. So songs are embedded in our culture. Not only, you know, If I Were Rich Man, Sunrise, Sunset, Matchmaker, Matchmaker. Who doesn't love Fiddler on the Roof, even in December when we're talking about Christmas shows?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those shows that as you see it in different times of your life, different things speak to you.
And also different productions tweak it a little bit to keep it fresh. So very much recommended.
And finally, you have some news. You've launched a theater company.
Yes. After almost 5 years of running Encore and reviewing something over 300 shows in that time, I have an affinity for Celtic theater. I'm half Irish and half Welsh, so I decided that Michigan needed a Celtic theater company. And so I've launched one called the Michigan Celtic Repertory Company, and we're doing our first production in December. It's Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales, and it's a show that was created by the New York Irish Repertory Company, which I saw a few years ago with John Cullum. It's beautiful. And so what they've done and will be doing is weaving the Dylan Thomas prose together with some original and traditional Christmas music. The story is, it's a family, you know, really on kind of Christmas Eve, and they're reminiscing about Christmas's past in that just beautiful Dylan Thomas prose. And so we have a terrific cast. December 8th, we'll be at the Carytown Concert House. And then on December 9th at, suitably, Connor O'Neill's Restaurant and Bar on Main Street in Ann Arbor in the Celtic Room.
Perfect. 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 So what have you brought for us to hear from this?
So this was from one of our rehearsals this week. Beth Mitchell, who's a terrific local soprano, and she's performing with us. And here she's singing in the Welsh, and some of the music we'll be doing is in the Welsh.
And as always, you'll find details on these productions. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lame ducks are flying around Lansing because today marks the start of the final post-election session of the state legislature. So let's see what we might expect from this lame duck session as we say hello to Zach Gorchow of Gongwer with us now via Skype. Always great to have you with us, Zach.
Good to be here.
So with more than 300 House bills still waiting for some action from the Senate and more than 200 Senate bills sitting in the House, is that backup typical for this end of the year?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, that doesn't even count the large number of bills that are going to originate from the House and Senate that will still move yet. You know, you can get anywhere from 100 to 300 bills clearing the legislature at this point in the term, and especially when you've got 8 years of total Republican control coming to an end, this is sort of this is put up or shut up time.
So they've got basically a month to jam through their to-do lists. I want to zero in first on the laws passed by the GOP-controlled legislature, raising the minimum wage for $9.25 to $12 an hour and requiring employers to provide paid sick time to their employees. Remind us again why the legislature passed those laws.
Well, the idea was if they had let them go to the ballot, because these were voter-initiated acts, and those proposals had passed, under the Michigan Constitution, it would take three-quarters majorities of the House and Senate to amend them. These are proposals that Republicans and their allies in the business community are very concerned about, and they were likely to be pretty popular. So the concern was they would not be able to amend them without Democratic votes, and Democrats like these proposals. So by adopting them via the legislature, you can now amend them via simple majorities, meaning the Republican majorities in the legislature and Governor Snyder can amend them without Democratic votes.
So what are we expecting to happen to these proposals during lame duck?
Well, I think we're going to see some pretty substantial changes. On the minimum wage side, the bill as it stands now would keep tipped workers at a different minimum wage than other workers earning minimum wage. The concern about the initiative from the restaurant industry has been that bringing servers up to the regular minimum wage could wreak havoc on their business models. The changes would keep tip workers at a percentage of the regular minimum wage. Over on the paid sick time front, the changes as they are now would deal with the record keeping requirements of the initiative and not put quite as much demands on what business and employers have to maintain. However, I should note with both of these bills as they are right now, they are multi-section bills, so they could be changed dramatically before they go to the governor. I don't know that that will happen, but especially on the paid sick time front, there's been calls for a lot more than what the bill does right now. So we're going to have to keep a really close eye on how these bills evolve as they move through the legislature.
And then let's say this all passes, basically, in a sense, gutting what it is that people said yes to when they signed the petitions. What could be done after the first of the year with a new governor and a change in the state legislature?
Well, I mean, the most obvious possibility would be to introduce new legislation. The problem, of course, is you would have to get it through the Republican legislature to get it to Governor-elect Whitmer. And I don't think there's much of a chance of that. So I would suspect that the other possibility, and I don't know that this would happen or not, but would be a new ballot proposal. And, you know, I wonder if we might see a constitutional amendment entertained this time around, because that would not be subject to legislative action. You know, again, don't know if that will happen, but that would be the other scenario to look at.
We're talking about what is on the radar for the lame duck session of the legislature, which begins today as we talk with Zach Gorchow of Gongwer. Let's talk about auto insurance reform, Zach. What might happen with that in lame duck?
Well, the main bill that's hanging out there, it's been passed by the Senate, it's sitting in the House, would allow choice for seniors on their auto insurance. There's been some thought that, well, wait a minute, you know, if you know, seniors who are covered, you know, their health insurance is covered under Medicare. Why should they even need to pay for health insurance under their auto insurance? You know, the auto insurance advocates have said this would destabilize the system by allowing a large number of motorists to opt out of it. But that is sitting in the House. Don't know what its prospects are, since it's been sitting without action all this time. I don't know that they're very good, but that's certainly one possibility.
There are certainly a long list of bills that might see action between now and year's end. Give us your big choices for things that we could really see get pushed through.
Well, I think, besides the minimum wage and paid sick time, I mean, I think probably the thing we're going to hear a lot about is going to be the bill to authorize the construction of a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac for the relocation of Line 5 and other utility connections. This is going to be a really controversial item. Governor-elect Whitmer has said she opposes this, does not want her hands tied. But if the legislature passes and the governor signs this bill, and Governor Snyder also finalizes negotiations with Enbridge for the relocation of Line 5 into this tunnel, the die is pretty much going to be cast. There's not much the governor-elect will be able to do. She'll have to enforce the law that's on the books. There's going to be a lot of people up in arms about this if that goes through. So that, I would say, is definitely a really big one. There's a lot of education bills that are out there. There's the A to F grading of schools. Teacher evaluations are sitting out there. Teacher bills regarding teacher prep schools. So that's a whole package of items. Online gaming, that's one to watch. Authorization of that could be a big one. There's still a number of bills dealing with sexual assault that the Michigan House passed that are sitting in the Michigan Senate following the Michigan State University Larry Nassar scandal, and I would expect a fairly substantial supplemental appropriations bill to go through, but how big it is going to depend on whether the governor gets two of his big priorities. He's looking to get a fee increase on landfills to pay for brownfield cleanups, and he's looking for the creation of a new fee on water bills to pay for water infrastructure. If those pass, the supplemental will be quite substantial, but even without it, there's a lot in there, especially when you look at the hiring of more Children's Protective Services caseworkers. There was a very scathing audit about CPS recently, and that bill would be designed to address some of those concerns.
And might we see anything move on campaign finance? Isn't there some legislation that's been introduced that might make dark money in Michigan even darker?
Yes, there is a bill that would basically say that nonprofit entities that currently do not have to disclose their donors would never have to. It's essentially, I think, to just make it that much more clear that, and put it in statute that they don't have to disclose their donors. That's the big campaign finance item that's looming. Although you do have another one that would allow a couple state senators that have debts remaining in their campaign committees from when they ran for the House and it would allow them to transfer funds from their Senate committees so they could pay themselves back, essentially, something they can't do now.
You know, I've got to wonder, everybody remembers what happened in 2012 with the emergency manager law. Voters spoke. They rejected the EM law. So the legislature came back and passed a new law and attached an appropriation so it would be completely immune from any further voter action. Might we expect to see that tactic employed on some of these controversial measures?
It certainly wouldn't surprise me. You know, and I probably should have looked at the Line 5 bill to see if that was already in there. Enbridge has said they're going to pay for everything in this tunnel deal. So they're going to have to be careful about putting any money in there and how that might be interpreted. But that might be one candidate, because that would be the kind of thing that you could see, you know, would have the organization behind it to go and get signatures. And you could see that having a lot of popular appeal to try to overturn the idea of putting the tunnel under the Straits.
Zach Gorchow with Gangwon News Service, keeping an eye on Lansing on this very first day of lame duck. And I know we'll be talking before those ducks fly off into the sunset. Zach, thank you so much.
Great to be here, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
A century ago, the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb destroyed half of Halifax, Nova Scotia, killing and injuring thousands. Up next, John Eubagen on his book, The Great Halifax Explosion. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 101 years ago this December, two ships collided in Halifax Harbor. The resulting explosion was the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb. It's known as the Great Halifax Explosion, and it's one of the greatest maritime disasters in history. Some 2,000 people were killed and many thousands injured. Yet this cataclysmic event is largely forgotten, at least on the U.S. side of our border with Canada. John Eubagen has changed that with his book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. I first spoke with John about his book last year, but let's revisit that conversation now in honor of the explosion's 101st anniversary. You know, we have talked about your books exploring football and, you know, Michigan sports programs and the mental health struggles of your friend, the late John Saunders of ESPN. Now for something completely different, the Great Halifax Explosion. What turned your attention to this?
Two things. The two sides of my family, the Bacons, were in New York throughout the whole process, the last 200 years. The other side, the Canadian side, went north to New Brunswick. My grandfather was 12 years old in 1917 when this happened. I used to spend my summers in New Brunswick talking to him. He kept on telling me about this, you know, two-ton anchor that went 2 miles this way, another part that went 3 miles that way. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't think he was crazy, but I never heard of it anywhere else until 1999, when I'm researching my first book on the history of University of Michigan hockey. It turns out Michigan's first hockey coach happens to have been a first responder, if you will, to the Halifax explosion. And that's what inspired him to become a doctor, go to U of M, and start Michigan's hockey program.
So you started digging and digging.
I did, and I got lucky and lucky, because it turns out his papers, his letters, Joseph Barge was a great letter writer, and his grandchildren, who are here in the state, and I know them, they've got his letters from World War I, where he served for a year and ended up getting hit with a shell and handicapped for a little while and overcame that. His letters from Halifax and his letters from the University of Michigan, and I just got really, really lucky.
All right, talk about this explosion, December 6th, 1917, in Halifax Harbor. When you think about how big was it? Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, this always stuns people that they had 6 million pounds of TNT and other high explosives on this ship. That's a bad idea. That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty on one ship. So you should not do that in the first place, but they were desperate. It's 1917. The Russians have left the war, so now the Eastern Front has been conceded to the Germans, and they're paranoid of the Germans rolling over the British, the French, and now the Americans who just joined the war. So you're overdoing this. Then, of course, you bump into another ship in Halifax Harbor. That's a bad idea. A fire starts. The crew takes off for the other shore, so no one is warned. And this ghost ship, now burning, slides perfectly into Pier 6 at the base of Halifax. at 8:46 a.m. So people are walking to work, they're walking to school, the school children take a detour and go to watch this thing. Thousands are watching the ship burn, and at 9:04:35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone. 25,000 are homeless, about half the city. 9,000 are wounded. 2,000 are dead in a split second. It was 1/5 the power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And we know that because Oppenheimer, who's the master behind the atomic bomb, he studied this at a conference at Cal Berkeley in 1942. It's the only other comparison they had for the A-bomb. So that's how serious this was. That's the horrible news. And the great news happens afterwards.
Indeed. Getting back to where we were historically, as you say, World War I had been going on for more than 3 years. The U.S. had entered the fight that spring of 1917. How key was Halifax to the war effort?
Halifax was the conduit for almost everything from North America going to the Great War. That includes Americans and Canadian soldiers, almost all materials, food, supplies, munitions, relief supplies, you name it. Almost any British soldier not already in Britain was going to go through Halifax, as well as the Americans. So that was a crucial, arguably the most crucial port during World War I.
And history happens when you get two entities winding up in the same place at the same time, that one in a million thing. In this case, two ships, the SS Mont Blanc and the SS Emo. Now, tell us about them and why they were in Halifax Harbor that fateful morning.
Mont Blanc was going to Bordeaux, France, to turn that 6 million pounds of explosives into shells to bomb Germans.
And basically, as you say, loaded beyond the gills with incredible explosives to the point where the captain said nobody can light a cigarette.
No one can even hold a match in your pocket. That's how terrified they were. They lined the hull with plywood to make sure there's no metal-on-metal contact because they knew that one spark could send them up. They secured the holds with copper nails because copper is one of the few metals that does not spark when struck. They feared that one spark, one rub, could send them all up. They lined their shoes, their boots, with canvas covers to make sure they didn't spark. So these guys in the ship knew that this was a floating time bomb, basically.
So they were pulling into Halifax Harbor?
They were pulling into Halifax Harbor, and they think after 4 days by themselves, no convoy, from New York, Brooklyn, New York, to Halifax, they think, okay, finally we're safe. Relax. And they went through not one but two metal gates underwater, which kept the U-boats, the German submarines, out of the harbor. So you're finally in. You're dying to get in here. It's 8:45 in the morning. The Emo, the Norwegian relief ship, was already a day late because of the same fences. The fences kept them from getting out the night before. So they're in a rush to go out. That captain is a hothead, which we make clear in this thing. So he's a problem, and he does not have any idea what Mont Blanc has on it.
Why is that? You'd think there would be warning flags.
One warning flag means the German U-boats just outside Halifax Harbor have you as a sitting duck. So about five guys in the whole harbor had any idea what was on the ship.
Okay. So
there's your problem.
There's your problem, because it really is a Murphy's Law.
One thing after the other. And safeguards, some of them stupidly, the protocols were removed because, you know, they're in a haste. It's World War I. Guys are dying overseas, left and right. So the British Crown did not care that much what's happening in Halifax. They're worried about their guys getting mowed over in the trenches of Europe.
Isn't this a big harbor? How did these two wind up bumping up? Bumping
it's a big harbor, except for one part called the Narrows, which are, in fact, narrow. It's all of a sudden only 1,000 feet across for about a mile, 18-mile-long harbor. It's the second biggest natural harbor to Sydney, Australia. It's a great harbor. But now you've got two ships trying to get out, get past each other, in this 1,000-foot-wide narrows, and the one ship, the Emo, keeps on ignoring the rules and going to the left and to the left and to the left of each successive ship. This is the same as driving a car on a two-lane road. You want to pass on the left, you better know what you're doing because there'll be a car coming by on the right. That car, in this case, was Mont Blanc.
Oh, boy. So they bump.
They bump. It's a game of chicken, and finally, at the last second, Mont Blanc says this guy's crazy and he's not going to get on the correct side. So they try to peel off the last second, as we would on the highways, and try to peel off left. So does the Emo at the last second. So they bump, and it's not a big bump, but it's the big enough bump to knock over the airplane fuel on top. They had unwittingly constructed the perfect bomb with a fuse on top and the heavy explosives down below.
So it starts to burn. And the crew of the Mont Blanc, as you say, they knew what was going on. They got off that ship and paddled to safety, didn't they?
They had two rowboats, 20 people each, and they went the other direction to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, across the Narrows.
And so here's this ghost ship.
This ghost ship now, which no one knows what's on it.
And the whole town's like, there's a ship burning. I can just see this. Let's go see.
It's exciting. And the war seems so far away, they don't imagine what's on it. So that's And the timing is cruel, like I said, because everyone's going to work and to school. The stoves from breakfast are still burning in every home in Halifax, which is going to matter.
And the kind of explosion, I mean, you take us to that moment. Give us a for instance. You have so many victims of this explosion. What story really hit you hard?
As far as the power of it, my grandfather's story on the 2,000-pound anchor being flown 2 miles, that got my attention. Windows were blown out 50 miles away. And again, the whole town is just flattened. If you were standing within a quarter mile of it, you were flown a quarter mile up the hill, and you had no idea what just happened to you. But all of a sudden, you're at a new park, Needham Park, on the top of the hill of Halifax. So you're watching it 1 second. Next second, you've got black grime all over you. You're wet from the tidal wave that happens afterwards, a 35-foot tidal wave, which drowned those who survived, the first thing. And no one can believe what's happening. And the look of bewilderment was repeated often by people. No one was screaming or yelling. They're walking around like zombies. Like, what has just happened?
And people vanished, didn't they? Some of them. Never to be found. No
trace.
There are
about 600 people we have no idea what happened to.
What kind of injuries, John, were most common?
Sad to say, facial wounds. Because the town, it's like a miniature San Francisco. They got these beautiful homes, two-story homes, with bay windows. Because the bay is beautiful, so they've all faced the bay. Everyone went to the bay windows and their workshops and so on to watch the Mont Blanc burn. Back then, there's no safety glass. This is the thin-paned stuff. So when they're watching, the facial wounds occur. About 300 or 400 were blinded during this process. And my great aunt, Aunt Ruth, lived in Halifax for a while. And you were taught when you grew up in Halifax in the 20s and 30s, if you see somebody with one of these blue-tinged facial scars, that's from the TNT itself, you are told to not stare because that's the explosion. So this went on for decades.
There was, amidst all of this disaster, you bring us some very special moments of human kindness, including a barbershop story.
And what's great about this is, obviously, a disaster you're never going to forget, but they remember the human kindness as much as anything else. And one beautiful little example among many in this book, Noble and Gordon Driscoll, 10 and 12 at the time, they go about an hour away for a haircut, because that's what we have to go for a haircut. That's where they're recovering. Mom gives them $1 to go in for a haircut. This is a week after the disaster.
Okay.
They still have glass shards, little bits of glass and wood in the back of their heads. So the barbers are cutting their hair and trying to get the oil out of their hair, which is very stubborn. And when the kid winces, when Noble winces, the barber says, "Ah, you must be from Halifax." He knows immediately. He goes over to the other barber and they whisper to each other, unbeknownst to the two kids. They go back and tell all the other customers, "We're not open today, got to go away." They give the kids two shampoos to make sure they get the oil out. They pull out all the little glass shards and wooden chips. And afterwards, Noble's getting very nervous because all he has is a dollar. And that will not pay for two shampoos and all the extra attention. He gives the barber a dollar, feeling embarrassed and a bit sheepish. And the barber waves it off and smiles. And with the other barber, they go across the street to a clothing store and buy the kids a new wardrobe because all their clothes are gone, except for what they're wearing. So, and 80 years later, what we remember is the barber. 100 years later now, that barber whose name I don't know, but that act of kindness lives on forever. And I think that's really, really cool.
I'm speaking with John Eubacon about his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And let's talk about that heroism, just like we saw after 9/11 when people and nations really came together, put aside differences to stand as one against a tragedy. There really was a coming together after the Halifax explosion, wasn't there?
No question. And it's true heroism. It really is. And it's from everybody. It's common people doing uncommon things. Just your neighbor all of a sudden going down into a basement to save a neighbor's baby. It is soldiers going into burning homes to get cats out, for crying out loud. It's again and again and again. The extraordinary heroism came from ordinary people. And we saw a lot of this during 9/11. This is on actually a grander scale because those are two towers that the firemen go up and that's about it. This is all over town. This goes on for about a day and a half, this endless burning. So a 14-year-old girl is one of our heroes. Joseph Barge, we'll get to, is one of our heroes as well. And it's really inspiring. So those of you who are tired of disasters, it's about a quarter of it is set up. Middle third or so is the explosion. And then the last, whatever that leaves, my math
yes.
is off, almost a third or so, more than a third, is how the city and the people responded, including the Americans.
Yes, because there were testy relations, as you point out. We get a good history lesson into the formation of Canada, and things were a little testy, but particularly the city of Boston stepped up.
Really quite amazing. And look, I grew up with more Canadian history than most, given my mom being a Canadian native. I had no idea that we were not allies at all in 1917. In 1776, when the start of the war, that side of my family, including 60,000 other American colonists went to New Brunswick
the
and
loyalists.
Nova Scotia. The American side of me calls them the scaredy cats.
Yeah.
The Canadian side is the United Empire Loyalists.
That's right.
So they basically founded New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, essentially. So they had no great feelings towards the U.S. In 1812, it's the Canadians versus the Americans, essentially, as well as the British, of course. The guy tried to burn down the presidential mansion, and he failed. He tried to burn it down, but it's made of white stucco,
yeah.
So you can't get very far with it. But it blackened it, and that forced them to whitewash it, which is why it's called the White House. That guy is buried with honor in the center of Halifax. So, and then you got Joseph Bars, the world's greatest privateer at the time in Canada. He sunk, captured, or burned more than 60 American ships, the most wanted man in America. And he was finally caught in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where they walked him up and down Main Street and fed him hardtack for 2 months.
A perp walk.
A perp walk. Yeah, the world's first perp walk, probably, I suppose. So we were not allies, even in the Civil War. Half of Halifax supported the Confederates, and with great danger they did so, because they wanted the cotton. In 1911, I can't believe this either, the Speaker of the House of the United States, the Paul Ryan of his day, got on the floor of U.S. Congress to vociferously advocate for the annexation of Canada, and he received cheers and a glowing report from the Washington Post. 1911, American leaders were talking about annexing Canada. So we are not allies.
But Boston stepped up to a point where it's even recognized today.
It is recognized today in no small terms. Boston, they're still shipping towns. And even though they're at war for basically 100 years, when it happened, the Massachusetts governor, Samuel McCall, without even being asked, they send 2 trains, 2 ships, 100 doctors, 300 nurses, all the supplies you could ever imagine to run a couple hospitals for a few weeks at about $1 million of supplies, which is $20 million today, without being asked. And you talk to any of the survivors in the 70s or 80s, late in their life, the first thing they always mentioned was the help from Boston. And it turned, by the way, U.S. and Canada into allies. That's where it starts. The Halifax is so appreciative. To this day, they spend $180,000 to find their best spruce tree in the entire province, 50 feet high or so. Usually a private citizen. They've got a cutting ceremony. They load it on a truck. They send it 600 miles down to Boston. They raise it in Boston Common for the holidays. They light it in a big ceremony. It costs them $180,000, and no Bostonians or very few have any idea why they're being thanked. But as a Haligonian, as they're called, said, they said, why should we stop thanking them? Which to me is such a great spirit and so counter to what we see internationally right now.
Indeed.
This is how people are supposed to get along.
And other things too. What, medicine? There were medical advances made because of what was encountered in the aftermath?
Ophthalmology, eye surgery was greatly advanced because you had all these doctors in town who spread best practices. And as I said, there are hundreds of blinded people from Halifax. Pediatric surgery. A guy named Dr. Ladd from Boston came up and he realized during the burn victims, the kid burn victims in Halifax, that you have to approach this differently than you do adult burn victims for various reasons. He goes back to Boston, has a 2-bed clinic, and from that he gets a whole wing. Talk to any pediatric surgeon, and they'll tell you the father of pediatric surgery is Dr. Ladd, and he learned it in Halifax.
And then, astoundingly, the Great Halifax Explosion, as you say, has a direct connection to men's hockey at the University of Michigan.
This is my favorite of the stories, as you might imagine.
I can guess.
But,
yeah, all things do come down to University of Michigan.
Of course
athletics.
They do. Why shouldn't they? But that privateer I mentioned,
yes,
who sunk 60 and burned and captured 60 American ships, his great-grandson also grew up not liking Americans too much. He fought in World War I. He's all gung-ho about it. He got hit with a shell, came back to learn how to walk again in Halifax when the boat blew up. And he knows first aid. So by the end of the weekend, he is basically performing surgeries he has no business performing, but it's all hands on deck, 9,000 wounded.
Because he'd been on the battlefield in World
exactly.
War I.
Exactly, so, and you got 9,000 wounded, so what can you do?
Yeah.
That's when he realizes, I don't want to be a businessman in Montreal, which he was, making good money. I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to be a pastor like my father. I want to be a doctor. I want to heal people, not kill them. And his uncle gives them $100 and says, go to the University of Michigan. And I'm not quite sure why. His cousin was there in surgery, so perhaps that was it. He comes to Ann Arbor. He marries a woman from Battle Creek, an American. He becomes an American citizen because the Bostonians so impressed him. He said, I've changed my view forever about Americans based on Boston. Becomes a citizen, goes down to Fielding Yost's office, the athletic director at the time, and says, you need a hockey program. He said, only if you're the first coach. So while a med school student, while married, he starts the hockey program. It has now won 9 national titles, which is a national record. It starts with the Halifax Explosion.
This is an extraordinary book, John Eubacon's book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. You put a lot of work, a lot of time into telling this story, and I can tell it has really grabbed you and moved you.
It has. And even writing it, I got choked up a few times. People have already read it, and the early going, you included, have gotten choked up a few times. It's a story about disaster, but how people respond to the disaster. And these people ended up living very good lives. That's incredible. They lost, you know, 5 siblings, and it's horrible, obviously. And they find ways to pick themselves up. And people who have interviewed them say they have such great perspective. They are so patient. This is before they passed away, obviously, in the 70s and 80s. And they're so good-hearted. And that's the lesson of this whole thing, is that no matter what happens to you in this world, somehow they have found a way to live good, productive, contributing lives.
A lesson for the ages. John Eubacon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can hear John Eubacon talk about his book, The Great Halifax Explosion, this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the City Opera House in Traverse City. You can learn more by going to nationalwritersseries.org. That's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.